And I'm joined by the number one New York Times bestselling author, Scott Turow, who is out with his brand new thriller. This is called Suspect. It is available everywhere, and it's his first book since 2020's Last Trial. The Last Trial was his previous book to this. He's written several, perhaps the best known is Presumed Innocent, that kind of got the whole thing started. But Scott, this novel, I loved it because I always expect a courtroom scene with you. This one isn't necessarily in a courtroom. It's an administrative setting, and it isn't a Sandy Stern novel that where Sandy is the main character. It's his granddaughter, this kind of funky gal, Pinky. Can you kind of set it up for this administrative thriller, more or less?
Yeah, Pinky is 33 years old, a very self-conscious outsider, eccentric, not very good at reading people, but because she is such an outsider, she's an excellent observer and investigator, and she proved herself with that skill working for her grandfather in his law office, and is now working as an investigator, as a trained private eye, with a relative through marriage, Rick Dudek. And Rick and Pinky are tasked with representing the local police chief, who's been accused by three police officers of sextortion, demanding sexual favors in exchange for promotions on the police force. And the kicker is that the police chief is female, and the accusers are men.
That made it an interesting setup to have a female police chief in this situation, and so it kind of tosses out the stereotype that we think of these sextortion cases. But as you dug into this and tried to research and make this sound realistic, did you find that this is really the exception to the rule, or is this more normal than people think?
Well, it's definitely the exception, but it's certainly not unprecedented, and there have been cases across the country where female superior police officers have been accused of demanding sexual favors either from men or occasionally from other women.
The part of the book that takes place that would normally take place in a courtroom, a lot of it's an administrative setting. You're not playing to a jury. You're not playing to one judge. You're playing to a board of appointed citizens. And so what kind of considerations do you have to take in when writing a thriller about with an administrative setting versus a courtroom?
Well, first of all, for whatever reason, my own career as a prosecutor and then a lawyer in private practice involved police disciplinary hearings. So I have a lot of experience with that. Brian, my attitude is that when you've got a witness on the stand and the witness is undergoing cross-examination, the central part of any trial experience is being repeated, whether it's an administrative hearing or a criminal or civil courtroom. So obviously the decision makers are not necessarily even law-trained individuals. They're citizens, and their decisions are then subject to review in the courts. But, I think the people in Suspect who are charged with making the decision about whether Lucy, the police chief, is actually guilty of what she's accused of. I think they're presented as sane and fairly responsible, even if all of them are not necessarily equal in ability and experience.
The book is written from a first-person perspective of Pinky, who's basically it's a young girl, and when you try to find the voice of a young female versus yourself, a seasoned male,
When you do that,
I would think that you need to try to capture the realism of it, but at the same time realizing your target reader is probably not a young female girl, and so you're not going to get the people writing into you saying, a girl her age would never say that. So what kind of thoughts do you think when you try to create that voice in your mind?
Well, first of all, that's a great point, and obviously was my number one concern in writing this book. When I started out, I never envisioned writing in the voice of Pinky, who is 40 years younger than I am. And, you know, as novelists like to say, it just came out that way. That's how I heard it, and that's what happened. And, you know, my editor was in disbelief, but you know, he ultimately agreed with me that it just sounded better in the first person than the third person. The considerations, I mean, you know, you listen a lot. You know, I constant reference to the internet. You know, I try to listen to my own children and stepchildren. And, you know, at the end of the line, you know, I got quite a bit of commentary from people who, you know, call themselves queer, meaning Pinky is bisexual, and are in the same age range. And, you know, occasionally I had missed the mark badly and they weren't afraid to point it out. For the most part, though, there was not a lot of criticism of what I'd done, and I, in the sense of saying, "No, this just doesn't sound right," and I was, you know, I was really pleased with that. But it's natural that you know, a book written by a 73-year-old male about a 33-year-old female is going to be, here comes a pun, suspect, and. I understood that to start.
When you have a book where the story is set up like this, and it's mostly the police officers are the accusers, and the police officer is the accused, one of these cops or more is going to be lying, and maybe everybody's lying about some things.
And so I
would think that as you try to do that, you struggle in your mind about the whole question of what is truth, and is ultimate truth versus legal truth on people's side. So how does that balance go in your mind?
Yeah, well, that's been a perpetual theme and absolutely necessary in writing about the courtroom. And, you know, in this novel, like most of my novels, the truth in the courtroom or the hearing room ends up being somewhat distinct from what the quote-unquote real truth is. The one thing, Brian, that I had to reconcile myself to going back to the writing of Presumed Innocent is that, you know, you and I have both been in courtrooms where you walk out after a long trial or a hearing or whatever it is and just kind of shrug at the opposing attorney because nobody really knows what the hell happened. And in a mystery, you are going to have to give the reader, at the end of the day, a definitive version of what occurred. And you can argue that that's, you know, that lacks verisimilitude. It's not true to life. But the mystery, and frankly all fiction, rests on the assumption that we can actually know what's going on in the hearts and minds of other people. You know, you can get into all kinds of epistemological and philosophical debates and say, you know, some of that is beyond words, and there really is no way to know that, because even the way we talk about it is a construct of some kind. But, you know, at the end of the day, we all know what we mean. And as I said, you know, the fundamental assumption in reading fiction is that we can enter the lives of other people and understand them.
I'm chatting with Scott Turow about his brand new novel, Suspect. It's a thriller. It's available everywhere. Scott, one thing when I read thrillers, I used to do this, and I don't do it so much anymore, is you always try to, as a reader, I try to guess the ending. That, oh, this is going to happen, mm-hmm. and then invariably I'm wrong. Do you have that in your mind as you write, that I'm going to throw a couple nuggets in here for readers to try to figure out, maybe they ought to get it from this? Because thinking back, I always think I should have caught this, but I don't. Or does that even enter your mind as a writer?
No, I mean... You know, I stumbled into the ending of Presumed Innocent, which, you know, without robbing those of your listeners who haven't encountered the book, which is being filmed again very shortly, I stumbled into that ending by a process of deduction and then saying, well, if it's that person, how in the world could that have occurred? And kind of working my way backwards to that result. And I'm well aware that when readers pick up a book of mine, they do expect the unexpected. I try to deliver. It's interesting that one thing I've learned over the years is that unless you deliver that big surprise at the ending, people sort of take it for granted along the way. And, I really don't regard myself as obliged to do that. In other words, here we go, folks, prepare yourself, it's the last chapter, and here comes your big surprise ending. I think that sort of undermines itself in a way. You want people to keep turning the pages. You want the end to be exciting, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, in my mind, you know, some kind of revelation. And I'm both aware of that, and I try not to write to a formula.
You mentioned the Presumed Innocent starts filming again. David E. Kelly has it. He's in charge of it now, and of course you couldn't find somebody better to have that in today's TV market, the fellow that did the Practice and all that stuff. But you've been through this before with Presumed Innocent, with the Harrison Ford, Raul Julia version.
Sure.
And so how does the Hollywood version of books differ now, this process for you, versus what it was 30 years ago when Presumed Innocent was the movie?
Well, it differs in so many ways, Brian. First of all, the new Presumed Innocent, which will begin filming for Apple TV Plus in January in L.A., is going to be eight parts, meaning that there'll be 8 hours of film time versus the 2 hours and 6 minutes that the Presumed Innocent movie had. The streaming series is really the novelist's paradise for, in terms of adaptations, because the principal problem with turning a book into a movie is that it's an abridgment. This is something that the late Brian Dennehy said to me on the set of Presumed Innocent. And, you know, it's an abridgment, and it's, as Brian said, it's no better or worse than a good Reader's Digest version of a novel. And so, number one is the immense popularity of streaming series works well for novels. And, of course, I'm far more familiar with the process. And I know how it goes. With whatever irony, David Kelly, whom I've known for many years, David's also optioned Suspect. So I hope he'll eventually go on, to making Suspect also into a series. His goal here is to use Pinky as a recurring character, so there'll be a different Suspect series each year.
Where do you think the courtroom drama has gone for so many years from movies? Because it seemed like, you know, Presumed Innocent came out, Few Good Men was out around that same time. But
right.
After that, the courtroom movies were just gone for so long, and now they're coming back in these streaming series. What do you think happened there?
Well, the saying in Hollywood is that television owns the courtroom, meaning that it's not good fare for the movies because there's so much of it on TV, the sort of law and order version of things where there's always in that series, whether it's the original or the reruns that are on a constant loop, that TV is so dominated and made so many courtroom dramas, that it's hard for the movies to compare. I don't buy that. I think what has gone on also in films is that they're increasingly dominated by, you know, superhero fantasies and what are called tentpole productions, meaning some immense high-budget film that's going to support the operation of a studio. And generally speaking, reality is shunned in the movie-making market. The ideal audience are, you know, young people who need to get out of the house and eat three bags of popcorn. And so it's these huge sci-fi spectacles that dominate movie-making right now. And because there's little airtime left for anything else that would be called quote-unquote adult, you just don't see courtroom movies. The irony, frankly, is that they're less expensive to make because, you know, most of it takes place in a on a set that, you know, is meant to look like a courtroom. And so they're cheaper to shoot, but, they're not popular for the reasons I've just discussed, which is, you know, that's not necessarily going to please the ideal movie-going audience.
I know one of the things that you've done in your non-writing career, in your legal career, is that you've been involved in the death penalty cases. You had a big case, I know, yeah, reversed years ago. That's got to be something still near and dear to your heart, but what's been on the forefront as you've seen reversals of convictions because of DNA and Innocence Project type stuff? How has that affected your career? It's probably something you never envisioned when you were in AUSA years ago.
Well, the advent of DNA is a truth-finding device, and quite frequently, innocence-proving device is, of course, something that changed during, you know, my lifetime as a lawyer. And prosecutors were hugely opposed to DNA when it first began being used in the late 1980s. And they thought it was just another gimmick that convicted defendants would use to get out of prison. Eventually, they realized that, you know, holy smokes, this is great stuff. We can prove somebody's guilty without, you know, virtually any doubt. We'll try fewer cases. We'll get, you know, people, for example, in the classic one-on-one rape case, we'll get people we couldn't have gotten before. It's become recognized as a truth-finding device that's, you know, depending on, you know, how good a specimen you've got, it provides, remarkable accuracy, at least in identifying perpetrators. And, that is a significant change. And I think, you know, if the goal of the courtroom process is to find the truth, assuming you've got good specimens, assuming you've got reliable scientists interpreting them, it's overall, I think, a very, very positive development.
All right. Well, the new novel is Suspect. It's a thriller from Scott Turow. It's available everywhere. And if you've never read a Scott Turow book, first of all, for the four of you out there that haven't, go pick up anything he's written. They're all fantastic. Scott, I absolutely love this character, Pinky. It's such a new thing for me to read in a legal thriller, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Brian, thank you very much for your time. Take care, and it was great to talk to you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Suspicion keeps us apart.